it was described as the right-wing Davos, with ticket prices to match. But what on earth is Jordan Peterson's ARC conference? And should we be worried?
First things first, the right is not split in this country. The Conservative Party is not on the right in any measurable way.
Our American friends are leading the way. DEI, a system of anti-meritocratic discrimination, is being dismantled, not just in the American government, but much more importantly for us here, in the global corporate world as well.
As we sent out the first invitations, we felt like we were literally lighting the beacons and calling to men and women of courage and integrity to come and join us, to come and work with us, to rebuild the very foundations of our civilization.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Zoe Williams. Today we talk to Stella Tiantikido, a rising star in the UK media, whose zany and occasionally outrageous Substack can be found at The Human Carbohydrate. Stella spent 3 days at the ARC conference and is here to reveal all.
Hi, this is Seema. I joined Another Europe is Possible in 2018. For me, the most important thing about this space is building a transnational movement for a more democratic economy, anti-racist politics, and global solidarity beyond nationalism. So that's why I hope you join the Another Europe is Possible family too. Go to anothereurope.org/join and sign up to get access to an extended version of this podcast.
Hey, Stella, welcome to the podcast. How's things with you?
Very good. I am exhausted after having spent 3 days and three nights, because I think the socializing is just as important, at the ARC Forum, the Jordan Peterson spearheaded conference. But yeah.
So you're basically in detox in multiple different ways from a far-right conference.
Exactly.
So I want to know what possessed you to go there at all.
Yeah, so people who follow my work will know that my, my unique selling point slash brand, whatever, is that I'm a left-wing person who talks to the right. So I go to this type of conferences a lot. And people are always like, oh, Stella, I'm so sorry you have to go through this. And I have to say, I always enjoyed delving into more people who think very differently from me, people who are very different from me. And I guess with especially the alt-right that has emerged over the years, I find both the people who end up there and the kind of weird mix of ideologies in there, I find it very interesting.
I want to know about the socializing, first of all.
The reason I was there to begin with, I didn't go there as a journalist who is going to... I went there representing the YIMBY initiative, so the YIMBY Alliance, and the main point was to find interesting people that were either interesting in the YIMBY agenda or that we could talk to for our media staff.
And you might need to explain that for our listeners. What's the YIMBY Alliance?
The YIMBY initiative, actually. The YIMBY Alliance is another one. But basically, this is just through the YIMBY Labour. There is a Labour group of MPs who, in my backyard, who are pro-housing and pro-planning reform, and activist organizations that have an interest in promoting that kind of agenda. The reason why we're taking an interest, I wanted to go to this event anyway, but someone had to pay because the tickets are extremely expensive. I ended up paying £450, which was the reduced rate.
Wow.
The actual price for the ticket is, I think it was £1,500.
Oh my God.
Yes. To go to the 3-day event.
So it costs a fortune and there were 4,000 people there. It was sort of billed as a right-wing Davos.
They said it was 4,000 people and that there were people there from hundreds of countries. There definitely was a diverse group in terms of nationalities represented there. By no means was it British dominated, if anything, perhaps America dominated, which makes sense. But it didn't feel like 4,000. And also they gave a lot of free tickets to people that they wanted them to be there for the clout. So influencers, a lot of big Substackers were there, were given a free ticket, a lot of big podcasters. But a lot of them I think a lot of them just popped in and out. They didn't stay at all. You didn't see them walking around. And I think it was Nigel Farage even said, you know, he was in and out. He didn't stay at all. And I think it's because it was not a very friendly venue / conference for people who think their time is very important and they will only spend time if it means, you know, people are constantly stopping them for a chat or an autograph or whatever.
Right. And just one more follow-up on you being there. Were you undercover or did they know you?
I always tell everyone who I am and they are perfectly aware of who I am and they invite me to the parties because... One thing that a guy told me, the guy who's organized the after party on the third day, he's a curator of Sovereign House. So Sovereign House is this social space in Dimes Square in New York City. Dimes Square, not Times Square, which is where all of these alt-left, alt-right types gather. It was thought by Curtis Yarvin. There is a rumor that it is funded by Peter Thiel. Obviously, I cannot find any confirmation that this is the case. But it's people who read, who listen to the Red Scare podcast, that ecosystem, if you're aware of it. So it's that kind of outgrowth.
Oh, yeah.
And the guy who curates Sovereign House organized this after party on the third day. It had to be reallocated in the last minute because someone gave away the name. And he texted me saying, was this you? And I was like, of course not. I do not cancel right-wing parties. I attend them and I write about them. You know this. And I guess it's what I do. I just hang around. I understand that for a lot of people, there would be an inner conflict, but I'm not suffering. At times I enjoy sometimes the company of the right-wingers I hang out with. They tell me every 10 minutes, don't write about this, don't write about that. And then I'm like, I don't need to write about this, but tell me what do you want the angle to be? And then they're like, I don't know, just make me sound cool or whatever. And I'm like...
It's interesting that you describe your USP as like, hey, you know, I'm prepared to talk to the right, the very far right, even. I guess you'd put Jordan Peterson in that kind of camp. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you saw that the organization More in Common this week published some like quite interesting data about the 8% most progressive people in the UK and how intolerant they are of right-wing opinions. And I think in some ways you're particularly novel because you're not in this kind of red-brown space, as it might sometimes be called. You know, you mentioned this kind of overlap world between the alt-right and alt-left, but you're on the centre-left. And so I think in some ways that might make you particularly unusual. I must admit that my reaction to the 8% polling that basically said, you know, the 8% most progressive people are extremely intolerant towards working with conservative voters and conservative activists, let alone reform voters or Nigel Farage. You know, it's something they would find inconceivable. And I would say for quite understandable reasons, but I'm in the 8%, right? But then I was honestly thinking, God, if they really broke that 8% down into the most left-wing component of the 8% and the most right-wing component, and then various different segmented shades within that kind of constellation, they would find that, Jesus Christ, those people hate each other on the left as well. Jesus, we're just like fundamentally intolerant of everyone.
Extremely. And I think it has to do with the fact, for me, I always thought it has to do with the fact that the people who go to the Conservative Party often will be ambitious more generally. They will want to lead more generally. Whereas in the Labour Party, or not in the Labour Party, because there is a lot of very centrist people in the Labour Party, but I guess the people who stick to something, to a very left-wing movement, means that you consider your morals to be so important to you and your politics to be so important to you that you are willing to live a lesser life in a lot of ways. You are willing to take jobs that will not make a lot of money. You are willing to try artistic or intellectual projects without having sufficient funding for them. The reason why something like the ARC Forum, did we say what it stands for? It's Alliance for Responsible Citizenship. The purpose of it was Jordan Peterson and Philippa Stroud, Baroness Stroud from the Legatum Institute and the Center for Social Justice. They are the ones who started this. And it is basically a way to, you know, to answer all of these philosophical questions about what it means to live a good life. How do we restore our communities? But really, the majority of the people there, I would say, are people who were fed up with cancel culture and a lot of other things. And it has transformed into something a lot more extreme and radical and incomprehensible, in my opinion. But their funding is abundant because they do not feel the need to water down. They do not feel like they have to water down their rhetoric. For example, you have one session where you have Sophie Winkleman, I think she's the Peep Show actress. She gave a very good speech, in my opinion, in which she was saying why she was making the case for why technology needs to stay out of school and why we need to be suspicious of AI and we need to stop trying to place human beings with technology. And at the end, when she was saying her proposals for what we need to be doing instead, she said, we should be putting more money into teachers. We should be putting more money into schools. I was thinking, wait a minute, are you sure you're on the right conference? Because I think the Labour Party conference would love to hear that argument. More money for teachers, more money for schools, sign me up. And in the next session, you have Peter Thiel saying, we need to fight back the Hollywood woke, who every movie they make, they portray technology as the evil. And I was thinking, how can you have these completely different ideologies in the same conference? What's the cognitive dissonance there? But that means, of course, that you can also have all of the people who are from the oil and gas industry, from the defense industry, US Chamber of Commerce more broadly, just being present there and giving money to this conference, because it means that all of the small C conservative and primarily Christian societies and think tanks that were also represented there, they kind of, you know how we used to say, oh, your companies are greenwashing the whatever agenda, blah, blah. That's what they're doing. I don't know what prefix I would put to the washing, but I noticed was, so the conference was 50% small C social conservative / Christian minded people who, some of them were not that extreme at all. A lot of them were, you know, I just want more community. I want family values, which doesn't have to be an extreme message. Doesn't have to be like David Brooks, for example, who gave the best speech for me in the conference. And I'm so pleased that they have uploaded on their YouTube because they did not upload everything very, very wisely. But David Brooks is the conservative columnist for the New York Times. And he advocates conservatism that is looking after the immigrant, looking after the poor, looking after the stranger. And that was a tiny part, a small part of the conference. Then there were the Christian ethno-nationalists. It's not cancel culture to say they were being very Islamophobic. And then there was, I would say, about a 40% generally US Chamber of Commerce, garden variety, you know, gas and oil industry, the Whole Foods CEO gave a speech. And then you have a 10% who are accelerationists, techno-optimists, anything downstream from Peter Thiel. So all of the different strands of... If I could be very generous, I would say there is a broader growth ecosystem of which I consider myself a part of because I received an Emergent Ventures grant from Tyler Cohen, the pro-growth economist who used to sit on the growth board and Liz Truss's government. But he's a US economist and he does a lot of things. He talks about talent. So all of this, it's a broad coalition. It's a very broad coalition. And this is where I would put the Sovereign House Red Scare people. I would put them in that 10% because they hang around together. They get funding from all of that. And the guy who was running the Sovereign House and the event, it was called After Dark, by the way, the party, he was telling me, oh, you know what, actually, Stella, it's good that we're here. We want you here because you allow us to continue existing. You give us this scene of neutrality. And it's what the GB News people always tell me. Oh, yes, we need left-wingers to come to our channel so that we can prove to Ofsted that we are not biased. And I was like, yes, you're doing a very good job on that. Sorry, to go back to the thing that he told me, as soon as he met me, he said, the social conservatives will accept any of the accelerationist, techno-optimist, big tech capitalist, monopoly stuff you tell them, because it goes over their head. They don't really pay much attention to what is being sold to them. They don't know the details of what Peter Thiel and other anarcho-capitalists want. They do not realize that they society, these people are envisioning it, is one where the billionaires of the world are around to have their own country and pay zero tax, and all of the poor live somewhere else, and the rich basically just wait for the poor to perish and die so that they can repopulate the earth with their own genetically modified superhuman offspring. And the big issue with all of that is that all of these people are voting for the same political candidate.
And that's concentrated in Trumpism in the US. But maybe let's just come back to that in a moment and stay on for the moment, like the look and feel of the conference. I mean, it's really interesting that these US actors were there. US Chamber of Commerce is a big supporter of Trump and clearly orientating to the UK political market, if you like. I was wondering, is there like a kind of celebratory atmosphere at the parties where people really like thinking this is our moment? Sure, we have a Labour government, but look at the polls, they're completely tanking, reform ascendant, Tories not so ascendant, but you know, the right wing vote together is pretty high. Was there a sense that this Trump has kind of made it our moment for the right?
What Trump has done is he and all of the people who have supported him and all of this ecosystem of podcasters and influencers who went on the journey to finally support a candidate as deranged as Trump. They've made it okay and even cool for people to say they are Nazis or fascists or whatever. So there is this sardonic, you know, half serious, half sarcasm style that is so popular in the Red Scare sphere of influence, where you never know whether they mean it or not. But they will come to you and they will say, I went to a sovereign house party on election night in the US. And it was pro-Trump. It was funded by an NFT token that has a lot of neo-Nazis called Milady, and from Polymarket. Polymarket is a crypto betting platform funded by someone from Palantir, which is technically unlawful to use in the US, but obviously everyone there was using it. And I went to that party and people would come up to me and they would straight away start talking to me about how the Holocaust didn't happen and Hitler had a lot of valid points.
Oh my God.
And yeah.
Jesus.
Many people are like that. And you never know. And for me, a lot of these people are faking it because a lot of them are young men who do not have a way to make their mark in the world. They see it as a fast track. They see crypto as a fast track to becoming rich. And they see LARPing as, LARPing, by the way, means live action role play, which is pretending to be something on the internet. LARPing as neo-Nazis as a way to get social clout and social status in the way that every human being has always wanted to do.
I really hear that especially, I don't know if you've seen those ASMR tweets about people getting deported. There's a very kind of manosphere YouTuber vibe to a lot of the Trump cheerleading, which does feel distinctively Gen Z, really, and not at all related to either kind of white supremacist old school conservatism or the kind of old guard anarcho-capitalists.
Of course, because all of these young men who are working and making their careers out of this movement, I would say, their personal politics are not that. They want to have casual sex with left-wing girls. They do not want to get married at the age of 23 and have five kids and get a standard 9-to-5 job. That's not what they want. They want to become rock stars. I'm not looking down on that. It's a human nature. It's a perfectly, you know, human tendency. But they are releasing. You have all of these middle-class boys on Substack at the moment in the UK. Really inflaming race war with the clickbait headlines about Africans bringing monkey meat to the UK and Afghan immigrants indulging in pedophilic traditions, blah, blah, blah. And I'm not even suggesting there that these people are lying or something like that, but they are just looking for evidence to inflame parts of British society that have been asleep for a very long time. Tommy Robinson parts of the society. Garden variety, football hooliganism, I just want to take drugs and get drunk and burn things up.
Can I just ask one question? I'm surprised that Peter Thiel was actually there, because as you say, there was a very high premium on this conference of looking like you were too important to be at the conference.
Peter Thiel's money is all over that conference. Everywhere in that conference, there were many people who are in some way or another funded by Peter Thiel. And Peter Thiel has funded a lot of good things. There isn't a black and white here. Peter Thiel, just like you can say, oh, Elon Musk is probably a pretty intelligent guy, you know, whatever, even though he's at the moment one of the most destructive actors of the human civilization.
Yes.
So it makes perfect sense that Peter Thiel was there. Peter Thiel is involved with a lot of... Peter Thiel is very intellectual as well. This is why Peter Thiel is so influential. And I read Peter Thiel. I am influenced by Peter Thiel.
If you can get through his gobbledygook prose, then there is something there of interest occasionally. It's an amazing recently, was it 3 or 4 months ago or something? The Financial Times let him write this complete gobbledygook like op-ed because he's Peter Thiel. Like it was sort of that end of academia that maybe I dabble in myself on occasion, where people like use extremely jargonistic terminology that no ordinary person can understand, that would never get through an FT copywriter, like generally, but Peter Thiel was there writing it.
Well, a lot of these people also, you know, like Peter Thiel used to write in a very clear and concise way, and through the years this has completely deteriorated. And it's the same with Jordan Peterson. When Jordan Peterson's first book that got him famous, 12 Rules of Life, was published, I read it and I quite liked it. And I thought, and this is, by the way, this is also part of how I got more interested into this ecosystem and how I felt comfortable. I felt intellectually curious. I didn't just read these people out of hatred. I was intellectually curious to hear what they were saying. And when I first read 12 Rules of Life, I thought, yes, I can see how there are parts that obviously would go against my own ideologies or political moral values. But he was able to synthesize philosophical, historical, spiritual, religious information, psychological information, create a narrative, take the reader with you, take a reader who may not be someone who normally reads a book like that, but talk to him about, you know, give him information that he's probably not going to come across anywhere else. And he was able to pull that off. He was able to pull that off quite well. But over the years, and there are rumors about him, you know, not rumors, he has also said it himself, he took a lot of SSRIs, he had a lot of mental health problems. He's completely lost it. During the first speech he gave in the conference, I was taking notes, trying to write down like what he was saying so that I can judge him fairly, judge his message fairly. And I realized halfway through, I was like, oh my God, he's not okay. He's repeating the same things. None of the sentences make sense. There isn't a central message. This is just an animal making animal noises.
Wow, that is amazing. When are you going to, have you written that up already?
No, to be fair, I've tried to pitch it to people before. I just post something on my Substack. So I'm going to post it on my Substack, The Human Carbohydrate, if everyone wants to follow it there.
Yeah, I really do want to follow it.
Plug, Claxon. So look, I just want to bring it back to mainstream politics, or British politics, if we can call it that. Take us away from the Peter Thiel universe. Like, were the big beasts of British right-wing politics there? I saw that you posted a video of Michael Gove. Who else was there? Like, was it somewhere to be, or was it somewhere that you wanted to say, as Zoe said, you know, I'm actually too credible to be at this conference, or, you know, that kind of thing?
Yeah, to be fair to Michael Gove, there was a spectator stand in the conference. There was a stand for Unheard and The Critic magazine as well. And there was a GB News live studio. Michael Gove was there, obviously, as the editor of The Spectator, and he took part in a debate, in an Oxford-style union debate, about whether protectionism makes us poorer. And it was obviously an Oxford union debate, so it doesn't mean that whatever they said was exactly what they believe. But Michael Gove made the case for why protectionism is good, actually. And I enjoyed it.
So was he, like, playing the protectionist, or does he actually believe it? Did that come out?
I think he definitely used a lot of tropes that I can see fitting with Michael Gove's character, but it was more make-believe, I think. But he was there as a member of the media. I saw a lot of Westminster hacks there from all of the major publications. I didn't see any other left-wingers apart from Maurice Glassman. I don't know whether you...
He is not left-wing anymore.
Yeah, so that he... You know what? I was Maurice Glassman is misunderstood camp. And then I realized that, oh, now he supports Donald Trump. And I'm like, okay, this is how now my patience and the pluralism and the and broad church left-wing credentials have been challenged to their limits. And this is the limit. You are no longer part of us.
What a journey. Basically, what you're saying is that apart from Farage, Gove, there weren't...
There was... Kemi Badenoch gave a speech, and she gave the speech on the first day. She was one of the first speakers, very first speakers.
Oh, okay.
Nigel Farage had a 15-minute interview with Jordan Peterson on the stage. Zia Yusuf, the chair of the Reform Party, he was part of one of the panels. Generally, there weren't politicians there, a lot of politicians. I know that there were, I saw some Reform people, but apart from that, it was mostly media hacks.
Because I feel with that kind of lineup, it probably would have got more coverage if there wasn't just so much Trump-led insanity news going on in the global order.
Well, the most worrying thing was that it did feel a lot like you have Kemi Badenoch there, Nigel Farage, flattering them with their what they were trying to say and saying Donald Trump is good, when the entire conference, it's not that the conference was just based on American culture, interests, what they like to hear about. It was American interests, literally, their national economic interests. They were promoting policies that are damaging for the UK, economically damaging in terms of our security. These people, I felt, they were trying to paint a picture of European countries, our allies, as the enemy within. And I was feeling through the least reported economic presentations that people were not paying attention to, that there was a sense that these people no longer see Russia. It wasn't even a sense. They were saying it. There were presentations like Erin Quinstein was saying, it's not China that you should be scared of. It should be France. So these people... The US is no longer a British ally, and we need to realize this sooner or later.
Yeah, big time. How would you sum up the overall politics of this? Because there's a sort of weird melange that Trump is creating. So I think about in particular his Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, here is quite a kind of orthodox conservative in some ways, but it's a sort of wing of orthodox conservatism in the United States that now has to answer that Trump is right about everything, and therefore does a lot of kind of intellectual gymnastics to try to make that coherent. So he would see himself as a straight up free market person. The market is always the answer. We need individual prosperity. We need low taxes. And implicitly, this draws the conclusion that, well, yeah, globalization was good, right? That implicitly.
Yeah, the free market is the answer, unless there is a nice, credibly rich tech billionaire who benefits from tech monopoly, in which case, let him have it. It is all extremely schizophrenic. I see it as anarcho-capitalism, free market fundamentalism, dressed up as Christian ethno-nationalism, and all of these things leading to the same candidate. They are abusing the fact that a lot of these small, socially conservative people will be there because they feel like this is the movement that represents their social interests and their social values, but they are not realizing that their social interests and social values to begin with were destroyed by these practices, by these. It's hooliganism, it's a societal, human civilizational hooliganism, what a lot of these bigger financial interests are representing. But this is why we don't allow showbiz people into politics.
Is that your way of saying don't elect me to be an MP for the Labour Party? You're doing yourself out of a job, Stella.
I know, I'm not helping myself, am I? This is why it's important for people to have political moral values of their own, and that they express them, and when they do, that you believe them. Because what we're seeing in the US with people who were fooled by Donald Trump and Elon Musk and are now realizing and changing their minds and are like, oh, wait a minute, this is not what I voted for. It's these are people who have policy positions based on single issues and based on their own interests. So always be very, very suspicious of people who they are very willing to go all out against their own side on specific issues in the way that they are. Their decisions are based on their personal interests. Their ambition is about themselves. Their ambition is not about the country. It's not about their communities. It's not about the whole world, because they don't have specific values. And this is why they don't feel like they have to express their specific values in the way that we in the left, you know, try to hold everyone accountable for.
Because I wonder whether what has happened here is that some of the kind of incoherence and eclecticism that you find in ordinary voters all the time, people holding simultaneously different worldviews together in ways that are often incoherent to objectively, but they're kind of mixed up together in many individual like voters and many individual people. But what the kind of new right is doing is taking that kind of eclecticism that exists in society and bringing it up to the elites of politics and then projecting it back and finding that this is actually quite successful because it sort of manages to be all things to all people.
Human beings are full of contradictions, and obviously I am an example of that. But for me, so I do have some social, small c conservative values, which I don't want to impose on other people. So for me, example, family is important. I'm communitarian. I do think that communitarianism can be quite a small c conservative sentiment. But I don't think that this is against my more socialist tendencies, where I believe that fundamentally workers should own part of the wealth that they are creating. I don't think that you can't have politics that hold all of these values. But I do think that then if you do believe in family values and all of that, you cannot be possibly voting for a man like Donald Trump.
I wanted to just come back on that contradiction and kind of mess of values, because George Lakoff always used to talk about biconceptualism. You know, everybody's biconceptual. Everybody has elements of Christ the warrior and Christ the savior. But really, when you read, I don't know if you saw that New York Times piece about vox popping people at the inauguration ceremony, it didn't feel like people were bringing a whole ragtag of values to their allegiance to Trump. It felt much more like a kind of superstitious stroke religiosity. You know, people were saying they thought he could solve all their problems. They thought they were using the language of a kind of promised land and bright sunlit uplands. And it feels to me like the next phase, basically. I feel like 2016 alt-right political activity was yoking together a lot of contradictory prospects, you know, like protectionism on the one hand and free market fundamentalism on the other. But now it feels more like it kind of feels more fascistic, is what I'm saying. It kind of feels like it's demanding a fealty based on thin air.
Well, yeah, it's because it's Peter Turchin, and he talks about cleodynamics, which is basically that, you know, certain events repeat themselves in history, and you can, like, you know, there's a formula for that. I'm not explaining it very well, but he's a great thinker and historian. And he says that in every generation, when you have war and dictatorships, where you have all of these violent historical events in society, which we have come to as afraid of and to not want to repeat, the first generation fights the war, then the second generation that comes after that doesn't want to repeat the same mistakes because they've seen the suffering and the death that has come out of that. So they make a lot of concessions. They come up with useful things like political correctness and things like that. And then the third generation, the sons, have forgotten all of these lessons. And they feel frustrated with the imperfection, the imperfect aspects of things like democracy and civility. So they recreate the conditions and the same mistakes that two generations before them did. And this is what is happening now. People are bored. Human beings are bored. Human beings want to go to war. They want conflict. They see this as a way for progress. They get frustrated when progress is slow, and progress has been slow. They are right about that. The pro-growth people are right about that. Progress has been slow in Western civilizations compared to previous generations. But now what they are doing is also because they felt a lot of these people coming from these communities have felt alienated from what they will say is socialist propaganda making us all atheists and whatever. But what is also, I would add, individualistic capitalism, which has made us lose our connection with a higher power, some kind of transcendence, some kind of spirit that makes us come out of ourselves and connect with something bigger. And for them, they are finding that in a movement and in the end, I guess, in a man who is promising them that he's going to be strong and he's going to be fix things for them. But, yeah.
And I think you see this in the modus operandi of Trump's project and operation increasingly. There's a kind of monarchical religiosity about it that's basically believes in Trump as a kind of personification of a 21st century divine right of kings. You know, of course, we've elected him. Of course, he can close down all of these American agencies without congressional oversight because he has the legitimacy of the American voter behind him. He's going to make America great again. So it kind of drives this centralization of power. And it is scary, but I just wonder whether there will be fractures in this part of the Trump coalition that it might be possible to exploit. I mean, what about, I know the Christian evangelicals who have spent decades building up links in Africa and putting in a lot of funding, are they really going to be persuaded that the US should close down USAID, the agency that provides 20% of all humanitarian aid on this planet, that is $40 billion a year, just because some of that aid goes towards, a very small proportion goes towards handing out condoms dealing with countries facing a serious aid crisis? Are they really going to be persuaded that something that they wouldn't support justifies taking this enormous sledgehammer to smash the nut that destroys the entire agency just because of one program that they don't like?
They already aren't, and there already is a schism. So I know a lot of, let's call them intellectual influencers who came out of the cancel culture wave, who are looking at all of this and thinking, this is not going to end well. Jordan Peterson has lost it. And these are people who are broadly, I would consider to be conservative and right wing. The intellectually honest conservatives are against this. So David Brooks, who gave, as I said, the best speech in the conference, he was the only one who went up there and he criticized Trump. He said Trump is not a conservative and he was booed for it. And he was making exactly this point that, you know, he used to go to Africa where USAID was fighting malaria, and these are all Christian missions, really. So I do think there is going to be a schism. I think it already exists. The problem is going to be that they are repeating, basically, they are playing from the left-wing playbook, which the left-wing playbook was focus on culture and social connections. And this is really how a lot of left-wing movements managed to flourish. They are doing the same thing with all of these social spaces and podcasts and even artistic material. But they're also making the mistake which the left did, which frustrated so many people and made them start going in different directions. So, for example, with free speech, if the left is saying that free speech is a value that we hold very dear, why did we genuinely socially ostracize so many people for having different political opinions from us? Why were we, which we were, like even during the Brexit referendum, we did socially ostracize a lot of people who had different opinions from us. Now they're doing the same exact thing. And what happens when you do this, you get a reaction. And we saw that in the left, they will see it very soon as well. I think they will see it much quicker than we saw it with the left.
So Stella, are you team like everything's fine with the Labour government? I mean, it might be languishing in some polls, like below reform, shock horror, didn't see that happening like in July of last year, by January 2025, you know, to have those polls come out. That looks pretty bleak. But where do you sit on the current Labour government? You described yourself, I think, as a bit of a general supporter.
Yeah, I'm a supporter of the Labour government. And even though I'm obviously a person who holds very passionate views about very many things, and I express myself in that way, I'm also a big believer in big projects, big umbrellas, and coming together with people who you think are going towards the same way as you are, in the same way that the right is currently supporting Trump. If there are conservatives who can find in them to support Trump, then I do not see why I should not be able to find it in me to support Labour government in all of its varieties, especially in the way the world is going right now.
So you're the perfect person to ask then, really. So what's happening? Why are they unpopular? Like, what's going wrong?
There was this Financial Times columnist this week, I can't remember who it was, who said that we should have more money for the opposition parties, because really the opposition party is meant to be preparing for government. And it's very hard to prepare for government when you have to put all of your diminishing resources into fighting an election. I think that this is what you're seeing right now, is you have 14 years where you're in the opposition. The administration of the party has changed multiple times, and it is incredibly difficult. The first 6 months of government are extremely, extremely difficult. And there are some things that I can point to that make me feel optimistic. For example, I am personally very optimistic about the changes to planning reform and housing, and also about the fact that now we are taking energy security more seriously. I don't agree with everything that we're always doing on energy, but I think energy security is the most important thing. The most important challenge facing the UK right now is energy security, and all of the other stuff, the culture war stuff, all of that is a complete distraction. I'm also very glad that we have Keir Starmer on the helm when what is happening in Russia and Ukraine, and with Donald Trump not being willing to pull his weight.
You're artfully avoiding the question. Come on, they should be in their honeymoon period. Like, what's happening? Like, you know, so for instance, I think when they came out, and you can debate the policy side of it, but when they got rid of the winter fuel allowance, that was a bit of a tipping point. And don't you think in some ways the language around that was part of the problem? I mean, it was communicated in this extremely miserabilist way, but it also reinforced a sense that the right-wing media have picked up, but the left have also argued this, that you can't really trust Starmer. It wasn't in the election manifesto. And a few weeks later, he came in and took however much of it is, a few hundred pounds away from every pensioner in the UK. That was surely bad politics.
A government doesn't have to do only things that are in its manifesto. What I was happy about with the winter fuel allowance is that there needs to be a government that is finally going to have the bravery to tell old people that this is unsustainable and that it can't continue like this. Because we will be told, I will be told, I'm a young millennial, I will eventually be told that none of these things will be available to me. And we need politicians to stop being so scared of old people voting them out. I'm generally not in favor of, I think welfare benefits of all sorts should be tapered. There shouldn't be a cliff on any welfare benefits. But it was a ridiculous situation where you had people literally spending winter fuel payments on champagne, on expensive champagne. So this needed to be rectified. Was it the correct way? Was this the right moment? No, I think in terms of, very clearly, the first 6 months were not mapped out effectively in terms of what policies are we prioritizing? When are we going to be announcing them? What is the most opportune moment for us to do that? There was a gap there. The media strategy was not working.
You see, I think, for what it's worth, I don't know what you think, Zoe, but I think they've just got an opportunity now with Trump really like declaring the end of NATO, that they could really come out and say, well, look, this means there's a global crisis. We have to rewrite all of our fiscal rules. We're going to have to raise taxes quite a lot. We're going to have to invest a lot in the armed forces. And we're going to do that in a fair way. And maybe we'll use wealth taxes. Oh, and by the way, because we can't really rely on the United States, we have to rejoin the European single market. I mean, they've been presented with this like enormous geopolitical opportunity, but I just can't see them responding to it.
I was very struck by something you said earlier, Stella, about how that there's a kind of narrative coming together that the US and the UK are no longer allies. And I think that, just to, it's a reiteration really of what you just said, Luke, but if they could catch up with that, it would really invigorate their language. But I just don't see anybody with the imagination or the bravery to catch up with that.
Yeah, that's not the narrative that's coming out. That's the narrative that I'm trying to create and push forward, because I think that that's what's happening. And the sooner we realize it, in the UK, we're more serious. This is why Steve Bannon always looked at the UK media to see what's acceptable and what's respectable. And because we are still more acceptable and respectable than the Americans, we talk about more real issues than them. So we don't really listen to all the American big influential lunatics for what they're saying. But they are very clearly no longer seeing, they don't care about the UK interest. They don't care about us. So what I want to see politicians is saying, enough is enough. You're no longer our allies because you do not care to support our interests. In terms of Keir Starmer, there was this on Times Radio, they were saying, oh, is this Keir Starmer's Love Actually moment? Is he going to go and do what the Prime Minister Hugh Grant did? I wish, I would love to see that. But even if he doesn't do exactly that, which you would understand why he wouldn't do that diplomatically. I mean, it's completely out of character for him in terms of his personality and the way he leads. But the fact that he's taking the responsibility of increasing our defense spending seriously, and I know this is not my most left-wing view, but the fact that he's doing that, for me, this is a great opportunity for the UK to lead the way and then have other European countries follow. Because once the UK and Europe is no longer beholden to the US to protect us, to take care of our security, then we no longer need to suck up on them every time we need to make a financial decision. Because we need to remember, Americans are going to be enriched if the industries in the UK, if our high quality, the Americans don't care to replace the Chinese industries, because Chinese industries, it's cheap labor. It is not the kind of stuff that their voters want to bring back. And it is, if anything, it's just extremely difficult to do, even if they wanted to. The European industries, however, our luxury car manufacturers and all of these other things that give us the good engineering jobs that European voters want to continue taking, they have their eyes on them. So it suits them that we become poor. It suits them that we have a dictator at our door and that we're constantly scared.